Broadcasting 24/7 from the bucolic campus of Hampshire College in the rolling hills of Amherst, Massachusetts, this is YURT, your radio for Hampshire College and beyond.
Hey folks, welcome to North American Psychotherapy. I'm your host, Henry Epp. Thanks for listening. I should start by telling you all where I'm coming from and what exactly I'm planning to do with this show. I'm a fourth year student here at Hampshire College. I'm currently working on my Division 3 project. To people not from Hampshire, that's basically a senior thesis. The main part of my Division 3 is fiction writing, short stories in particular. I've also sort of minored, though there's not really traditional majors and minors here at Hampshire, but I've kind of minored in American studies here. So my intention is that each of the three stories that I write will deal with themes and characteristics that, to me at least, are distinctly American in some way. Along the way, I'll be exploring what exactly that means. I think there's a lot of connotations to that, and I'll also be writing a nonfiction essay that will focus on the early stages of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in the context of the United States' history of both militarism and isolationism. And that paper, like the war itself, could go in a lot of different directions. I'll keep you posted in future episodes. The final part of my Division 3 is, of course, this show that you're listening to right now. I've got a slot here at the Yurt, 8 p.m. on Wednesdays, and that's once a week, but once a month I'll be doing a show like this, where I'll fill the slot with the kind of stories and commentary pieces that you're about to hear today, in addition to some interviews and field pieces in later episodes. In general, it'll hopefully sound very professional, and I apologize if it doesn't right now. This is really kind of the first time that I've tried to do something involving a lot of professional-sounding things on the radio. So I thank you in advance for your patience. So let's see, let's get on with it. Each of these shows that I'm going to be doing will be explicitly focused on one of the themes that I'm trying to infuse into my fiction writing. And those themes range from home, which is the theme of today, to conquest and rebellion and all kinds of things. All right, you got all that? I'm already exhausted. Thanks for listening. That's Devotchka behind me right now with their song Contrabanda. You can find out more about them at devotchka.net. So the theme for today is home, and that's pretty broad, but in some sense, it's universal. Everyone has a home, even if it's not a physical, permanent space. Though some of us are without homes or have never had a home, there's probably some sense of home within us somewhere, right? I mean, after all, they do say home is where the heart is. So, unless you're in the midst of open heart surgery right now, in which case I have no idea how you're listening to me, you've got a home of some kind. First, I want to talk about my home. I grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Because that's a city in the Midwest, most people I met when I first came to college assumed I was from some sad, tiny little town in the middle of nowhere, or that I grew up on a farm. Neither of those things are true, of course, and perhaps because of those assumptions, I've spent most of my time at college strongly defending the city of Minneapolis. It's got about 400,000 residents, and it's a vibrant, crazy, and cosmopolitan metropolis. It's even right next to St. Paul. But we Minneapolitans don't really like to talk about that. Anyways, though I've been away for most of the last 4 years, Minneapolis still feels like home to me. In some way, it probably always will. Right now, at least, Hampshire also feels like a home to me. and I'm guessing there will probably be many more places in my future that I will consider to be home. That brings me to something else. I feel that there is an inherent need in this country, the United States that is, to strive for a permanent physical home. For generations, a home and a family have been the ultimate goal for most Americans. Yet, simultaneously, America has always been a restless nation. Many of us strive to pick up everything or leave it all behind and set off to start something new. That's next episode's topic, rebellion. But home and rebellion go hand in hand. Really, you can't have one without the other. With that in mind, it seems appropriate, to me at least, that Thomas Jefferson's original wording of the Declaration of Independence, you know, that thing that officiated the American colonies' rebellion, was life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. Rebelling in order to get property, a home, a homeland. Of course, he changed it to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for his final draft, which has a lot more connotations, and I guess is a bit more appropriate, or it at least reads better. At its core, a home is ideally a place of happiness and comfort. Coming up, we'll hear how, more often than not, that's a pretty false ideal. Just as homes are easily created in this country, they can easily be wrenched apart, or even deliberately left, only to unwillingly creep back into a person's consciousness. We're about to hear two stories of experiences right along those lines. Home isn't easily definable, but it's a struggle, one whose outcome is rarely predictable. But if we have one, a home that is, we'll always long for the comfort of it. Stay tuned. Yola Tengo. If you don't know them, you should definitely check them out. They've been around forever. They're great. I saw them live just last week, and they put on a heck of a show. So our first segment today comes from a Hampshire student who responded to a request I sent out about last week on the Hampshire Daily Digest for stories of home. What it means, where it is, where it once was to people in the Hampshire community. I was surprised, though I don't know why in retrospect, that most of those who responded were people whose homes had been broken, most commonly through divorce during their childhood, or whose families had constantly moved, never maintaining one physical home for very long. And the speaker about of what you're about to hear chose to remain anonymous, though his voice may be quite recognizable to folks at Hampshire, at least. As a child, he grew up in what seemed to be the perfect middle American home environment. But by his high school years, that all had changed. Take a listen.
Home has always been kind of a problematic issue for me, and that's to say the least. It started off really simple. Really, really simple. White nuclear family living in the suburbs of Cleveland, Ohio. Dad, mom, sister, myself, and our cat. Pretty much the poster of traditional. This had me lulled into a blissful false sense of security, and it didn't help that I'm the youngest, and therefore the least informed and most naive. First came the divorce. At the time, it was soul-crushing. Divorce was something that happened to the other families, the poor families, the dysfunctional families. I had been so blinded by my sense of standards and traditions that I couldn't even see that we were one of the messed up dysfunctional families. So that news hit pretty hard. It didn't take long for that situation to reach normalcy. I didn't have to hear my parents argue or hear my sister and mom argue either, since my sister pretty much lived at my dad's. She and my mom never got along, and me, being the passive young one, got two houses. Not bad. But my mom's new house never felt like home. It was the second house. I didn't want to move my stuff out of my dad's place into hers. My dad had a nicer house, my dad's house had my sister, my dad's house had all my belongings, and in general, my dad was much nicer of a person. Turns out parents aren't exempt from breakup drama, and when it came down to it, my parents' friends took the side of my dad. My mom's house was a place of isolation, of separation, uncomfortable unfamiliarity. So I had my home, and I had my mom's house, which was sort of a peripheral secondary home. That was easy too. I mean, for everyone but my mom. And things stayed that way for a bit, until my dad died of cancer. That tore my world apart. My sister and I stayed in his house for as long as we could after he died. It was still our home, though it was empty of its owner. We avoided his room. That's where he died. It was kind of creepy and certainly not a permanent solution. The question loomed over us, what was going to be our next home? Was I going to be separated from my sister because of this? Turns out I was. My sister and my mom's disagreements never seemed to end, and still don't to this day. Her moving into my mom's was out of the question. Instead, she, with only 1 year of high school left, moved into the home of my dad's friends, my mom's now ex-friends. I moved into my peripheral home permanently, with a fairly weak relationship with my mom, and my sister living somewhere else entirely. This was in eighth grade. My sister's home was always warm and friendly, but it wasn't my home. My mom's house was cold, lonely, but it was destined to be my home for the four bitter years throughout high school. My mom continued to isolate herself throughout these years, and a psychological examination of her could be an essay unto itself. We didn't speak much, and she spent most of her days inside her own home. She took on projects like painting each wall a different color. I thought it was hideous. I hated that home, and I just hoped college would come soon. Finally, that day did come, but that brought its own complications. Literally, the day after I left for Hampshire, my mom, with no friends, family, social life, or even so much as a job, moved out of her house and went to Chicago, in a tiny one-bedroom apartment. I was completely uprooted. We ended on a relatively passive note, but I knew that her house would never be my home. I showed up to my room in Dakin, the closest thing I had to a home. I didn't even have a permanent address. Hampshire College had on file that I lived in Chicago because of my mom. The United States Postal Service sends my mail to my uncle's apartment in New York. My driver's license still says I live in Ohio, but to me, Hampshire College had to be my new temporary home. With this came a certain amount of freedom. While my friends all had obligations to go home on breaks, I've always been able to take myself wherever I want. Home for me was, and is, literally wherever I lay my hat. In many ways, I'm liberated, free, and yet I feel like I belong in none of these places. I graduate in December, a prospect that terrifies me. I need to find a home. Where's it going to be? At least I don't have to worry about moving back in with my parents. But where do I go? My friends will still be at Hampshire, and I'm not ready for my experience here to end. Hampshire's been my home for a while now. I'm prepared to bite the bullet and be that creepy grad that hangs out on campus, but that's delaying the inevitable. I'll graduate, and I'll have almost too many options before me. but it's a freedom I should embrace. My lack of a real home since high school has rendered me a champion of packing my bags and plopping them down wherever I feel like. And honestly, as much as a relief as it would be, I can't see myself living in one place for more than 4 years at a time.
Well, it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, even you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, it'll never do somehow. When your rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm a-traveling on, but don't think twice, it's all right.
That is, of course, the legendary Bob Dylan. And before that was an anonymous Hampshire student telling his story of home. Up next, we have a story of home unexpectedly returning to its past owner. Liz is another Hampshire student who, besides her first name, also asked to remain anonymous for this show. I've known Liz for a while, and just as a social human being, she seems at home pretty much anywhere she goes. After many miles and years away, one of her homes caught up with her just last week.
But don't think twice, it's all right. So it ain't no use in calling out my name, gal.
I live full-time now in Northampton, Massachusetts, but I'm originally from Seattle. I've only not lived in Seattle for about 4 years, but sometimes I feel like I've completely destroyed, and intentionally destroyed, my connection to that place, to the point where somebody asked me a year or two ago how I got to high school every morning, and it took me hours, it took me the rest of the afternoon to remember that my dad had driven me to school, because I remember a time when my parents were married and I lived with my dad. And for most of my teenage years, I had these friends who were really destructive people, really difficult people to be healthy around if you're weak like I was. My best friend, Lucy, and I, we had been best friends since we were three. I dropped a block on her head in preschool when I was three and she was two, actually, and we were glued at the hip from then on for like 12 years. All of my childhood memories have her in them. All the pictures of my birthday parties and, you know, road trips and camp, and it was all me and her together. She was the dreamer, and I was the practical one, and she would come up with ideas like we were going to be child prodigy fashion designers, and I would do all the, I would get all these supplies and come up with a business plan and do all these drawings and stuff, and she would do some drawings too and whatever, and then she would come up with a new idea, and that would be scrapped, you know, a couple weeks later, and we'd move on to something else, and I have huge piles of all this stuff in my house that we generated together in that time that I've been getting rid of over the years, but I've still got a ton of it in the back of my closet. When we went to middle school, she went to Woodward, which was the mainstream middle school, and I went to Odyssey, which was the alternative one. And it was great because I made some new friends who were all depressed. And that worked out great for me because it gave me words to put to how I had felt for years. And suddenly the fact that I was anxious and moody and hated myself made me cool and I fit in. When we all got to high school, Lucy became a part of the group by virtue of being my best friend. What should have been obvious is if you put that kind of self-loathing together with that kind of wildness and passion, you get incredibly self-destructive behavior. And all of a sudden we were all living like we wanted to die. We were experimenting with serious drugs, and we were cutting, and most of us were having casual sex, and we were 14, and it was a mess. And then we got a wake-up call when we were sophomores in high school, when Kaisha tried to kill herself. And Tony got there first, and he called the ambulance and gave them all the bottles of what she'd taken, and he was the responsible one, always, and he saved her life. I thought, it seemed obvious to me, that we were all going to change. We were going to get healthier. We were going to do it for her sake. We were going to do it for our own sakes. But a couple months later, when she finally got to come home and when she was allowed to have her first unsupervised visit with us, the door closed and Jen, whose house we were at, pulled a Rite Aid bag out from under her bed that was full of cough syrup bottles and we had, she was going to have, and they had a little, like, yay, your first day out of rehab, welcome home party. And I pulled that trick where you call your mom and you say, what, really? I have to come home right now? But I want to stay. I just got here. And she totally got the message and came and picked me up. And I never really hung out with them again. I hung out with them in school and stuff, but I didn't look back. They weren't the people that I was going to let influence my life anymore. And that included Lucy. No matter how much I loved her, she was part of this path they were on, and I had to look out for myself. And I think that that decision probably saved my life. And I actually told that story a couple days ago to my best friend now, and he said, oh my God, you're so lucky. And he thought about it for a second. He said, no, you did that on purpose. I'm so lucky. Lucy's family and my family were always really close because we had been close for so much of our lives. And so, and we still got along really well. So we would see each other a few times a year. Our paths kept divergent, stayed divergent. She would disappear for 8 months at a time and no one would know where she was, and she'd turn back up, and I, you know, went off and went to college. But when we got back together, it was always kind of weirdly comfortable. Our families got together last year, the last time I saw her, for Christmas brunch. She and I snuck outside for a cigarette afterwards, and we ended up talking for hours. And we still had the same sense of humor, and we got caught up on each other's lives. And she had been living in Reno for a while after she got busted for soliciting in Washington. And she was covered in horrible little tattoos of Playboy bunnies and pistols and four-leaf clovers. But she was still Lucy. And she told me that her boyfriend got out of jail and her warrant expired about the same time in 6 months. And they were thinking of moving back to the Northwest. And I was like, great, you know, we'll see more of each other and we'll keep in touch. And but I was already living here. You know, I considered myself a full-time resident of Massachusetts already. And it was sort of like, well, you know, I'll move back to Seattle someday and we'll be friends. And then last Thursday, she overdosed and died of on recreational accidental death. And I was at the Haymarket Cafe in downtown Northampton when my mom called me and told me, and my roommate Charlie was working a block away at Sam's Pizza, and I basically had a panic attack in the Haymarket. I just started sobbing. I was alone at the Haymarket, and I sprinted over to Sam's. I left my computer and all of my stuff sitting out on the table, and I sprinted next door to Sam's, and I don't know what I thought. I just thought, you know, I couldn't be alone. I couldn't deal with what was going on in my head, and Charlie would fix it somehow. And I walked in, and I stood inside the door and made eye contact with him at the register, and he just stared at me. He didn't move, and I was a mess. You know, I was very visibly a mess. I thought he would jump into action. It turned out later that he didn't recognize me. He had no idea who I was. When he did realize who I was and started to come around the register, my knees gave out. I collapsed to the floor, and he had to, like, carry me downstairs to the manager's desk and prop me up in the corner with, you know, a roll of toilet paper and a bottle of water, and go back to work, and kept coming down to check on me. He got some of our friends there, and they calmed me down and went and got my computer. And I was a total wreck for about an hour. And then my mom had told me that I had to call my dad. By the way, them speaking on the phone was the first time in 8 months, which was a big deal. He had called her and been inconsolable, and that she thought I should call him. And when I did, he said all this horrible stuff like, oh, it's such a waste, and it makes you really appreciate the people in your life, and, you know, talking about all these memories of her and me in, like, this really practiced, ugly solemnity. It was totally unemotional and totally trite, and from that moment, I switched from being in agony to being, you know, pissed off at him and then just completely numb. So I hopped on my bike and rode. It was torrential downpour rain, and I hopped on my bike and rode around and got wet and tried to feel something for a long time. And I finally ended up going home and getting on Facebook and trying to find phone numbers of people from back in the day, and it was impossible. That was the first time I realized how successfully I had cut myself off from these people, because I didn't have anybody's numbers. I wasn't even Facebook friends with most of these people. I finally found one number after, you know, getting in touch with somebody who got in touch with somebody, and it was Kaisha, the friend who had tried to kill herself. And I found out that she already knew, first of all. She was still friends with Lucy. Lucy's boyfriend, who had taken her to the ER, had gotten in touch with Kaisha, obviously, because they were all still pals. She and Lucy and Jen had just gone camping together, like, the weekend before. And I was totally blown away by this, because it had never occurred to me that they would have stayed on that exact same trajectory for the past 6 years. And I called more friends. I called Tony and Eric, who were also friends from the old days, who I was on better terms with and who I'd seen in passing and had their phone numbers and stuff. And they had not heard, but they had more helpful responses because they sort of felt the same way I did. They were freaked out and upset. And Eric kept saying, "The girl you and I knew was gone such a long time ago, and I don't know this girl who died." Those were the words he said. And it was strange because he was right. I mean, he was wrong for me. I mean, I still loved her, but it was true. What he was saying, it was like, this doesn't change my day-to-day life. Why do I feel the way I do? It was surreal because in that afternoon, talking to all those people from back then, I got to see a glimpse of who I would have been if I had stayed there and if I hadn't broken away. It was this whole person who still lives there and who probably didn't graduate from high school and certainly didn't go to college and who never got to be as happy as I am. And I was incredibly grateful. I felt this surge of love for the home I have now, for my friends and my family that I've made here. But I realized that person is always going to be someone who I was, and in that way, always someone who I am. Strangely, my relationship to that time is a lot less complicated now. I think I'm grateful for that too.
The lameness lovers always faster.
Everybody, that is Local Natives behind me right now with their song World News. They're a great band. Also seen them live in concert. And before that, of course, was Liz's story of home and its elastic tendencies, I guess. I just want to interrupt here for a minute and say that if you are listening to the show and if you have any suggestions, if you have a story that you think you'd be good to tell here. The next topic is going to be rebellion. If you have a story on that topic, or if you just want to give me a word about what you think, you can email a new email address I just set up for this show, North American Psychotherapy, and that email is napshow, napshow at gmail.com. All right. Well, before I go, there's one more piece I'd like to share with you. You can call it a commentary, a rant, or whatever. It's not directly about home, but more about an increasingly common way that people spend time in their respective homes, particularly in this day and age. And it's most likely how you're spending your time right now, in front of a computer screen, listening to the show, and probably doing other things at the same time. Here we go. Maybe it's just me, but we seem to be the generation of dissatisfaction. Born and bred in an age of consumption, we expect content to be delivered to us at a rate and with an abundance that would overwhelm and shock past generations. If you were to ask, I honestly couldn't tell you the exact amount of time I've spent on the internet today, or yesterday, or the day before. I couldn't tell you how many links I've clicked on, how many words and pictures I've looked at, or how many articles I've skimmed. And this was a productive day for me, one where I actually closed my laptop and read a book for once. And not just a few pages at a time between unnecessary distractions, but actually sat in the library and read about 30 pages in one continuous sitting. I don't mean to brag or sound holier than thou in any way. Frankly, it's a pretty pitiful accomplishment. I didn't even finish the book. I'm about halfway through. Maybe I'm just supposed to be restless, distractible, and dissatisfied with things as a 21-year-old person. Maybe that's just what 21-year-olds do. Or maybe, and this is the tricky thing to admit, I'm privileged enough to feel dissatisfied with a bountiful life full of love, familial support, and friendly camaraderie. But isn't it that same wonderful privilege that's given me access to an education, a computer, and an internet connection? And isn't that internet access what's tunneling a barrage of infotainment into my brain every single day? Okay, yes, I'm incredibly privileged, I know, complaining about absolutely anything when I'm at a private liberal arts school in New England makes me a huge asshole. I get it, but hear me out for one second. There's something that is making me feel as if there's a fog between me and the human interactions I take part in every day, be they handshakes with new acquaintances, a hello to a friend, or a kiss from my girlfriend. Again, I get how selfish that is to say, oh, poor me, it's like I'm shrouded in a fog while I waste away at an innovative bastion of higher education that my parents pay for me to go to. Yeah, I get it. Just let me talk. Hold on. Our media culture is always leaving me expecting and wanting more, and if I can't be glued to my devices to check the next update or read the latest headline, I'm thinking about checking things while I'm interacting with other people in real life. And that's where I think dissatisfaction is coming from. I mostly bring this up because I know that I'm not alone. Outside of myself, I see this happening all the time to all kinds of people, and probably I'm much closer to the sane end of the spectrum of internet age social dysfunction disorder, IASDD, if you will. I mean, I don't even have the internet on my phone. If I feel this distractible and dissatisfied with just a laptop, I can't imagine how miserable and disgusting I'd be with an iPhone or a Droid or whatever the hell people have. I never want the internet constantly at my fingertips. That sounds awful to me. No matter how many Verizon commercials I see that make it sound so incredibly appealing and necessary in today's world, I think I would just cease to function as a human being. I would just be a sack of waste, aimlessly wandering through life, missing the view while I check my Facebook. I also worry that someday I won't have a choice but to give in. I think what a lot of this comes down to is that I miss being a kid. I really do. I desperately miss the simplicity of being 10 years old. Being just old enough to understand some of the world's complexities, but young enough to hold on to an innocence that allows me not to care too much. But maybe that nostalgia is also for a time that was slightly slower technology-wise. Okay, it was the 90s. It wasn't that long ago. But I remember having to wait for a VHS to rewind. Do you remember that? We wouldn't be able to put up with that now. Waiting minutes to reload something? Ridiculous. In the end, it's inescapable. I will keep going on the internet. I have to a certain extent. But I desperately hope that just as frequently, okay, maybe half as frequently, all right, every once in a while, I step out the door, forget my cell phone on my desk, and take a walk with no particular destination. And most importantly, I'll feel adequate, content, and satisfied. Everybody, that's the show. This is the new Pornographers behind me with their song Chump Change from the album The Electric Version. Check them out as well. thank you again for sticking out this inaugural episode with me. Again, if you've got a story you'd like to share on the show, next month's theme is rebellion. Shoot me an email at napshow@gmail.com. Or if you've got any suggestions for me, like maybe I should have put a little filler between the two kind of intense stories that we heard today, I'd love to hear them. Same email, napshow@gmail.com. Finally, a couple little announcements before we go tonight. And they kind of relate to home and what I've talked about. First of all, I would like to give a shout out, as the kids call it these days, to my parents who are at home right now, Nancy Olison and Steve Epp. Happy anniversary. I think like 26 years or something. That's quite something. and yeah, that's the show. Thanks for listening, guys. All right, till next time, stay sane, everybody. Good night. And I promise if you take me home, I'll sing you a song. Never leave me alone. Say, come on, baby, throw me alone. I'll sing you a song. Never leave me alone. And I promise if you take me home, I'll sing you a song. Never leave me alone. Say, come on, baby, throw me alone. About me. That's my favorite subject. I don't know if you picked up on that yet or not. I never said I had a business mind. I just don't believe that quitting time exists. Ain't no finish line to this. You gotta give me mine. I really shine. My given time is this. Live and die with the grind, driven by the fist. Where do you place my name if I never played your game? We don't race the same. I don't run inside no painted lane. Plus, y'all pace is strange. Y'all need to stop or you sprint. Run when it's sunny and hot if it changed to rain. I wouldn't be half the Ali that I am if I slowed myself up and tried competing with these people, fam. I'm every bit as unconcerned as they are unprepared. Market flooded, needless to say, I wasn't scared. This all dropped the same day, I don't fucking care. Put listening stations in the store and let the public hear. Better yet, let's have an in-store performance. Make it oranges to oranges, me dwarfing your endurance. After that, we'll shoot the shit with our supporters and see how many more discs of yours the indie stores order. See, you already know I out-rap them. On the low, we out-work, out-think, and out-class. And I promise if you take me home, I'll sing you a song. Never leave me alone. Say, come on, baby, throw me a bone. I'll sing you a song, never leave me alone. And I promise if you take me home, I'll sing you a song, never leave me alone. Say, come on, baby, throw me a bone. I'll sing you a song, never leave me alone. Nobody's doing this thing exactly like we do. They do it, they just ain't doing it like us. Suck-ass motherfucker. My personal pedigree so bonafide, cause a man of my stature ain't grown overnight. The undisputed king of where po folks reside, because every time I speak it, the whole vocalized in you. Sitting bitch with them chickens about it isn't fair. The sound system ain't shit, but I was crystal clear. We first name bass sound, man, we bring them beer. Plus I tipped them 50 last semester when the click was here. Listen here, I ain't gonna give you all the secrets. Just these few examples help me illustrate my pretense. Our strength is unrelated to your weakness, cause you'll never be a worthy pool appears to be competed with. I see my shit with Sun House and Zill Johnson and always lose. I done lost face too, but I'm sporting they shoes, so let me remind you. I'm the kicks you trying to fit, we outgrew them shits in high school.
And I promise if you take me home, I'll sing you a song. Never leave me alone. Say come on, baby, throw me a bone. I'll sing you a song. Never leave me alone. And I promise if you take me home, I'll sing you a song. Never leave me alone. Say come on, baby, throw me a bone. I'll sing you a song. Never leave me alone.
I don't think I'm arrogant, man. I think I just, you know, I do what the fuck I does, man. Kiss my ass.
It's of foremost importance. There is none like unto the brother out this motherfucker. Regardless of stop all the nonsense. You see me lounging, call rhymes, stay as office. I've officially lost it. They say my reputation precedes me. I don't know the meaning of off season. I ain't taking it easy. Ain't taking a day off. Never had an off night. Never been laid off. I live on the job site. It all pays off. But when I squint through the spotlight and see your lips are moving to the true shit that
waiting, I'm patiently persevering. I see greatness in the person in the mirror very clearly, and that's why I take this seriously. Baby, come near to me and truly, truly hear me.
And I promise if you take me home, I'll sing a song, never leave me alone. Take a moment.